It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Janice Dean.
I'm Brett Baer.
I'm Martha McCallum, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, October 20th, 2022. I'm Dave Anthony. The special counsel probing the origins of the Trump-Russia probe lost another case in court, adding fuel to the fire for Democrats critical of John Durham.
Whatever he comes up with in his final report is not trustworthy and not reliable because he's made allegations before and he hasn't been able to back them up.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Childcare was already a tough thing to find and pay for. The pandemic made it much worse, and the lack of childcare now may be impacting the ability of moms and dads to go to work.
At least in Maryland, we had a surplus of money, and that money needs to be used in the parents and the workforce. You know, a lot of parents now after the pandemic are start working again, and they need to go back to work.
And I'm Dr. Nicole Sapphire. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
Not guilty. Not the words John Durham wanted to hear, but the special counsel heard them in court in Virginia this week. A federal jury acquitted a Russian national on 4 counts of lying to the FBI. Igor Danchenko was charged for his role in the infamous Steele dossier that dug up dirt on then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016.
We've known all along that Mr. Danchenko was innocent. We're happy now that the American public knows that as well. We thank these jurors for their hard work and deliberation in reaching the right result.
That's Danchenko's lawyer, Stuart Sears. Durham is investigating the origins of the FBI's Russia collusion investigation, which former President Trump has always called a witch hunt and a scam. But Durham also failed to get a conviction in May, prosecuting former Democratic National Committee attorney Michael Sussman for lying to the FBI about his role furthering Trump-Russia collusion claims.
The fact that he is 0 for 2 is probably going to undermine the good that he has done and is apt to do in his final report.
Andy McCarthy is a Fox News contributor and former assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York.
The upside of these cases, Dave, has been that he has put a lot of information out in the public domain using these trials as a vehicle that shows a lot of alarming government abuse. And it shows that there's a lot of evidence for the proposition that he seems to have arrived at, that the Trump-Russia collusion storyline was a political attack that was concocted by the 2016 Clinton campaign, and that the FBI, at the very least among government agencies, was a willing collaborator in the promotion of that narrative, even though it didn't have a strong basis in fact. So he's put a lot of information out that is along those lines and shows us a lot of abusive things that the FBI did. So that's all to the good. But the fact is, you know, anti-Trump people and Democrats are going to use the fact that he got acquittals in these two prosecutions to say that whatever he comes up with in his final report is not trustworthy and not reliable because he's made allegations before and he hasn't been able to back them up.
All right. Now, the New York Times, others, also there are other reports, called it either a high profile blow or a final blow for Durham and this acquittal for Danchenko. Let me read you from the Times. It said that Mr. Trump and his supporters long insisted that the Durham inquiry would prove a deep state conspiracy. He did not charge any such conspiracy. And again, he went after lying to the FBI, false statements, and he lost even on those. No conspiracy charges against anybody.
Yeah, I was wondering when I saw that whether Charlie Savage had written a piece after the 400-page, 2-volume Mueller report came out complaining that no one had been charged, but yet the prosecutor had put out all of this information. It seemed to me at the time that the Times was mighty happy to have the information. So I just think it's a peculiar charge to make.
It's kind of strange, isn't it, though, in the end, Andy, that in one investigation, Republicans say, see, it's a witch hunt. You didn't get anything but people giving false statements. And now in this case, Democrats say, see, it's a witch hunt. You didn't find anything but false statements. Have we gotten anywhere in 5 years?
Well, I think we haven't, if that's the level that people want to look at it as. I've never really looked at it that way. I wrote a book about this called Ball of Collusion back in 2019 about the Russiagate investigation. And what I tried to argue in the book, and this is very unsatisfying to people. I know this. I go around the country and talk to people and they want to throw stuff at me when I say this. But so far, they haven't actually thrown anything.
Well, that's good.
They certainly have waved their hands angrily anyway. But a lot of things that are in the nature of abuse of power simply are not law violations. Let me give you a concrete example, which I think displays what the problem is. Let's say somebody comes to the FBI and says, I have it on good authority that Trump has a very troubling relationship with X Russian person who's close to Putin. And there seems to be some exchange of money going on, but it could just be a real estate transaction.
Okay.
Now, mind you, I want to be clear to people. This didn't happen. I'm just making up a hypothetical situation to make a point. If I'm an FBI supervisor and I would normally say, that's really not very hard information. I'd need something more concrete before I would open a criminal investigation. Yet in this instance, I'm also somebody who happens to not like Donald Trump. And I think, on balance, it's a gray area, but I think I'm going to open this investigation. And I think I'm going to poke around and do some of the things that the FBI can do to investigate whether there's crime there. Well, you can't say that there's nothing there to investigate. You can't say that in opening an investigation, I'm violating any rules of the FBI because they're very minimal requirements for opening an investigation. And it may well be that if you could read my mind and look into my heart, you would know that if this was Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump, I wouldn't open the investigation. But have I committed a crime? No, I've abused my power. I've opened an investigation that I wouldn't open in ordinary circumstances. I've done it out of political motivation, but there's nothing in the penal code that makes that a crime. And the reason that this is an important point to make is, if you set up a situation where people in law enforcement have to worry that they're going to be prosecuted over the judgment calls that they make, then they're not going to enforce the law.
Back to that Danchenko trial. The Steele dossier was at the heart of it, indirectly funded by Hillary Clinton's campaign, which hired a law firm, which hired a research firm, which led to the report by British agent Christopher Steele, who was anti-Trump and cobbled together information that smeared the then candidate in 2016 and was used by the FBI to obtain warrants to do surveillance on ex-Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. The Inspector General's report concluded there were serious failures at the FBI related to that dossier and the warrants.
There's nothing wrong with taking information. In my career as a prosecutor, I took information from murderers. I took information from terrorists. I took information from fraudsters. Even Yankee fans, I would occasionally take information from. So I'm some of the worst people you've ever met.
You must like the Mets. Are you a Mets guy?
I'm a Mets guy.
I knew it.
But the thing is, it's what you do when you get the information. You have to corroborate it before you use it for anything important. And the problem with the Steele dossier isn't so much that they took the information, it's that they didn't verify it before they used it in court. And probably the most alarming fact, there were a number of alarming facts, but maybe the most alarming fact that came out in the trial as Durham presented his case, and this hasn't been, the fact that there was an acquittal doesn't mean that this didn't happen. Nobody has refuted or disputed this, and this was sworn testimony by the FBI agents who were involved. They offered Steele $1 million if he could corroborate the information he brought them, and he could not. Because of that situation, there are special rules that impose on the FBI a heightened responsibility to bring verified only information to the FISA court. So unless they've corroborated it, they're not supposed to bring it there in the first place. If you're offering a guy $1 million to corroborate the information, that means you shouldn't be filling out and swearing to something that you call a verified application in a federal court. Yet that's exactly what they did.
All right. So You've been through this in investigations, as you pointed out. Is that $1 million offer something that has done a lot? I mean, is that typical?
Well, it's not done a lot, but it's not unheard of for the federal government to pay for information and services. For example, I did a terrorism case in the 1990s, the blind shake prosecution that arose out of the World Trade Center bombing.
Yeah.
And
the first World Trade Center attack, right?
This correct.
Is 93?
Right, 1993. Right. Yeah. And we ended up paying the informant in that case $1 million. Now, understand, because he cooperated with us, he was undercover. He went in and made tapes against very dangerous people. His life as he knew it and his family's was over. We had to relocate him. He was never going to have another safe day in his life. But importantly, this was a, you know, this was a negotiated deal. You do this for us, we do this for you. And it was written in a contract and it was disclosed to the jury so they could make of it what they chose to make of it. And if you think about it, Dave, let's say, you know, we have a different situation than what we got in Russiagate. Let's say you had had somebody who was running for president who really was a clandestine agent of Russia. If you said to somebody, if you can corroborate that to me, that would be very valuable to the United States. And then the guy went out and actually brought you back, you know, smoking gun, tape recorded evidence that showed the guy was a clandestine agent of the Kremlin. That would be worth a lot more than $1 million to the United States. But I think the relevance here is that they had to make the offer because they knew the information wasn't corroborated, and yet they used it anyway.
So now we've had the acquittal number two. This is it, do you think, for the special counsel Durham as far as trials go?
Yeah, I think that there's no reason to think that there would be any other trials. And the reason I say that, there are a multiple reasons for it. One is the behavior that he's looking at here goes back like 2015, 16, 17. Most federal crimes have a 5-year statute of limitations. So we're really like up against the end at this point. He's apparently let his grand jury lapse. So unless he's brought any other charges that we don't know about and he's got them under seal, which there's no reason to believe he has, we're not going to see any more. So all the signs are that he's done with prosecutions and what he's got left to do is to complete his final report.
Do you think people are too weary to care anymore?
I think when people's day-to-day is, you know, high prices, financial anxiety, and crime, it's a lot to ask them to think about the importance of things that happened 5, 6, 7 years ago, even if they are very important.
So this still matters, in your view, very much?
Yeah, yes, it does, because something happens and then people complain. But the reason that the things continue to happen is because we're not paying any attention to the need to reform. It's one thing to complain about the things that happen, but you know, when the same kinds of abusive things happen again and again and again, and yet we don't change the system, we don't reform it, we don't change the way that we conduct oversight, we don't reconsider what its budgetary authority is and its legal authority is, then how does anything ever improve?
Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, current Fox News contributor. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
This is Dr. Nicole Sapphire with your Fox News commentary coming up.
If you have little kids, or you even know someone with little kids, you know the childcare struggle is real, especially if both parents are working. The expense of childcare prompts some parents to at least temporarily leave the workforce, but for many others, finding the right daycare becomes critical.
Nationally, 4 out of 10 parents have gone into debt due to the cost of childcare, and almost 3 in 10 have had to choose between paying for childcare or paying rent.
Washington Democratic Senator Patty Murray chaired the Senate Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee hearing regarding child care, or the lack of it, earlier this year. During the pandemic, many operations closed down and many did not reopen. One witness's written testimony said the sector is missing 16,000 child care programs and that 100,000 child care workers have not returned. Even some who have end up quitting for higher paid work, as the average hourly wage for a child care worker is about $13.
This is not just terrible for parents and kids, but our economy as a whole. I have heard from businesses across Washington State who are losing workers or unable to hire new ones because parents can't find child care.
Murray said a Democratic plan would have wealthier Americans paying more in taxes to pay for more child care. The ranking Republican on the committee, outgoing North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr, said that would end up costing too much and eventually shift those costs to the states.
How can we move things forward on a bipartisan basis where we add value to the country but don't add debt?
He pushed for more child care block development grant funding and criticized the Democrats' plan as partisan. Child care did not end up being a part of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. There is some agreement on this topic. Available child care could mean more labor force participation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says the rate is more than a point below where it was in January of 2020. In August, there were 10.1 million job openings, and with unemployment at a low 3.7%, the gap leaves many companies looking for the right workers, some of whom may be home taking care of the kids.
Particularly after the pandemic started, we have been facing a lot of, you know, economic struggles, obviously, in the industry.
Carolina Reyes is the director of Arco Iris Bilingual Children's Center in Laurel, Maryland.
The recognition that the country has towards our fields is very minimum. I think that the struggle that we are living with the people who work in the fields, one of them is the lack of appreciation towards our field, and also the low wages that many of the people who work in this field have. And now with the economic crisis that we're going, you know, the inflation is everywhere, everything is expensive. People who work in the field are leaving the field because they can get better wages somewhere else. And even though many of them may have the passion to work in this beautiful and amazing field, they're leaving because the economic struggles that we're all facing.
Yeah, I know you were the highlight of a New York Times piece about this issue. And you said specifically that someone you had hired for $15 an hour left you to go make $24 an hour cleaning high
yes.
school classrooms after hours.
Yes.
Is that a typical thing that has happened for you?
To be honest with you, I was shocked because I always try to talk to my teachers, and compared to other centers, I think I pay them well. That's the minimum that I pay here, and I go all the way to $22 per hour. And I'm a very small, tiny bilingual preschool. And when she told me that she was making that, and she said, "Miss Carolina, I have to go because everything is getting very expensive and I need to get this money. And even though I love working here and I love working with children, my necessities are much higher." And when I asked, when they was like, "Can you please share with me, just to the sake of my advocacy, how much are they paying you?" And she said $24 per hour. And I was like, wow, I'm not going to be able to compete with that. And I called her the other day to see how she was doing. And she mentioned to me that they do a lot of professional development. They told her that they can offer to pay for classes if she would like to go to college or something like that. So the benefits are very significant, right? So that.
Yeah, we keep hearing that wages are going up in most sectors, you know, not enough to deal with inflation, obviously, but something. Is that not the case for childcare workers? Like, you can't charge parents more to pay your staff more?
Exactly. I mean, we already have heard this around the country that childcare is very expensive and that a lot of our families are spending. I think I read or somebody shared with me that they're supposed to be spending 7% of their income in childcare. But the reality is that families are paying 30% of their incomes in childcare. So, yes, it is very expensive. So think about us charging more money to be able to keep our teachers. The truth is, we already are spending the majority of the money that we make in wages.
Carolina, tell me, what are your costs like? Are you buying food for the kids? Do you have to pay to maintain a license? Like, how much does it cost you to run a child care center, obviously, aside from, staffing salaries?
Salaries, rent, insurance. Obviously, the food that we provide, I provide breakfast and snacks. And, other expenses that come along with it, like, for instance, professional development, that in my particular case, I do pay for that. I pay for conference for my teachers so they can continue promoting what I want to promote as an early educator, which is quality early childhood education. And that means that I had to be paying for all the requirements for me to be able to hire that teacher, which is fingerprinting. If I want to hire a teacher, I pay for the fingerprinted. I pay for them if they need to go to the doctor. So a lot of that is expenses that you have to pay, And in my particular case, due to the pandemic, I had to relocate my business. So I had spending money in, physical things such as the playground equipment, trying to do fencing and all of that. And we don't realize that the little money that is left over is not much. It's a very small business. So with the pandemic, in Maryland, I was closed for 3 months to 2020 through the pandemic, and then we were open. Then that's what I'm telling you. The crisis was very, very rough. We were only allowed to have 50% of the capacity that we used to have. So if you have a capacity of 60 children, we only could have 30. So for some families, that was a struggle because they were not able to have somebody. You need to think about that. Not many people have a support system at home. And this is the important thing, I think, that I want to highlight. I think childcare in America, for many of our families, we are a support system for them. Without us, they don't have anybody else who can help them. And that is why I think it's very important that we need to start investing somewhere or another in our families and children, and obviously in the workforce, right? Because we do so much. And I think what I am offering to my families is a quality early childhood setting in a bilingual, environment with appreciation of diversity and multiculturalism. And it is sad sometimes to be able to see people come into my center and they're like, I love it, but I cannot afford it.
That's actually one of my other questions is, do you have conversations with parents? Like, if a parent is making $30 an hour, then maybe paying for childcare is worth it. But if they're making 15 or 20, then maybe it isn't worth it. Like, do they come to you? Do you ever have conversations with people about needing to leave the workforce to take care of their kids because of just the amount they make?
Yes. And depending what a family is making, you can see it's affordable and it's not affordable, right? But the example that I wanted to share with you was that I had a mother who, unfortunately, she was going through a separation. She was working as a child care assistant in another center. And she had to leave that work because now she needed to make more money. And she was applying for the child care scholarship for the longest time. And there is always was a barrier that she was not able to, get the scholarship. And what I did is I saw the struggles because I'm a woman. And I told her, that's okay, come, let's do it again. Let me help you again. I help her to be able to do all the paperwork for the child care scholarship. And I was able to tell her to pay 50% of the tuition so that way she didn't have to take her daughter out of.
Wow.
Because, she was going to put it with a friend in a house. And the daughter was already, engaged in the school. She was already participating, doing so much learning. And for me, just to see that a family needed to take their child out because she didn't have the means to pay, I tried to do a little bit of assistance and say, let's work together. Let me help you. And she finally got the scholarship. But she went through so many, red tape through the process for her to be able to get that money from the state. And in many cases, and this is my advocacy that I do sometimes, in many cases, there are families who may not have English as their first language, right? So
right.
I think we need to some way to be able to help these families to get this money and not too many barriers to be able to get it because we have the money. The money, at least in Maryland, we had a surplus of money and that money need to be used in the parents and the workforce. A lot of parents now after the pandemic are start working again and they need to go back to work.
Carolina, tell me, finally, that there was a hearing earlier this year before a Senate committee about this very issue. And the women who testified basically said that the federal government needs to step in here, do something to help. But some may not want, you know, their taxpayer dollars going to something like other people's child care. What do you say to that?
I think that we probably need to change a little bit of the mentality of how we see things. I think that we are a community. We belong to an amazing country. We have people who may have better resources than others. And I think we need to put ourselves in the shoes of other people sometimes, you know, and see the reality. Because in this country, we may have people who may have the resources to have, you know, a good life, right? You know, have the opportunity to have access to a house, may have access to food, they may have access to private education or, you know, or just a better education than others. So I think it's time for people in general to really to think that we are a community, and one way or another, we need to help one another. And it's important that, you know, our government, it doesn't matter which party, in my opinion, start really thinking that early childhood education is essential for our society, because education does not start at kindergarten. It starts before. It starts at birth. And all of us in childcare, we are not just caring or watching your child while you work, but we are providing something much more and more fundamental for early childhood education, which is a support in the social and emotional foundation. So early childhood education starting at birth is essential because, in my opinion, we are the base of education. Our children, they need to have the opportunity to have quality early childhood education, and we need our government to start spending money and helping, you know, everything that goes along with it.
Carolina Reyes, director of the Arco Iris Child Care Center in Laurel, Maryland, thank you for joining us.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. Gracias.
Meet the American who
invented the hard hat, Edward W. Bullard.
The hard hat is the team headgear of working class America, the people who built the United States with their bare hands, the people who still build it today. So we all tip our safety caps to Edward W. Bullard, born in 1893. He was a U.S. Army veteran who crafted the world's most important piece of industrial protective equipment after returning from the carnage of World War I. His first hard hat was called the hard-boiled hat, as its components were literally steamed together. Bullard applied for a patent for his product in 1927 and received approval in 1929. His hard hat soon played a key role in some of the nation's most ambitious and most dangerous construction projects. Bullard's safety hats were used widely in the Golden Gate Bridge construction and the Hoover Dam. The hard hat became a symbol of working class America during New York City's hard hat riot of 1970. About 33 million Americans, or roughly 10% of the national population, work hard hat jobs every day. As Mike Rowe told Fox News about Bullard, quote, "On behalf of all hard-hatted dirty jobbers, we're grateful." Bullard died in 1963 and is buried at Cypress Law Cemetery in Colma, California, just south of San Francisco. His legacy lives on today in the success of many of the nation's most ambitious construction projects and in the daily experience of millions of hard hat workers from coast to coast. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section at foxnews.com to find more of these incredible American stories.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Dr. Nicole Sapphire.
What's on your mind?
The Food and Drug Administration has authorized the bivalent COVID-19 booster shots from both Pfizer and Moderna in kids as young as 5 years old. Approval from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention followed in lockstep, as they have for the last 2 years. The new updated bivalent booster targets the original version of SARS-CoV-2, as well as the currently circulating Omicron variants. The FDA points to their analysis of data from adults who received the Moderna bivalent vaccine and kids who received the old monovalent booster to guide their recent decision. They also said they are approving the Pfizer bivalent vaccine for kids because it is made in a similar fashion to Moderna, despite no supporting data submitted by Pfizer. The FDA authorized the bivalent booster for adults in late August without any human data. The only available information at the time was from a small study performed on mice, yet it was approved nonetheless. Within a few days of the FDA okaying the bivalent booster in kids, Pfizer released human data on the bivalent booster in adults, which show an increase in circulating antibodies 7 days after the dose. Does it offer increased protection against severe disease? Unclear. How long do the antibodies stay elevated? Also unclear. To put this plainly, there are no data on the bivalent booster shot in kids. Kids remain the lowest risk for developing severe COVID-19. To recommend boosting them, a benefit must be clear. Yet the efficacy data are non-existent. So what about safety? There are no safety data in kids in the bivalent booster either. They have also not assessed how kids would respond to repeated boosters if they already received one or have recently recovered from COVID-19. Plus, the booster data the FDA referenced in their authorization studied the original booster given 5 months after the two-dose series in kids, not 2 months as they are now recommending with the bivalent booster. They are not taking into account the growing numbers of cardiac inflammation cases in young, healthy people following the vaccines and boosters, most commonly after repeated doses. They are also not taking into account that the virus has weakened, thus causing less severe illness. It is impossible to understand how the FDA could approve and the CDC recommend a new booster for kids without any pediatric data evaluating the risk and benefit. Americans need better data. Unfortunately, these seemingly innocuous recommendations from the CDC expanding the use of boosters leads to mandates that can ultimately harm children. Harm can be done either direct from potential risks of the vaccine and boosters, or indirect through learning loss and discriminatory exclusion from activities. And for what? There is no proven benefit at this time, less if they confirm they are safe. That's probably why the FDA and CDC bypassed their own expert advisory review committees before making this decision. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, has publicly apologized for the mishandling of the pandemic. The FDA lost two high-level executives because of approving boosters with insufficient data. This is another missed opportunity to show parents they have kids' best interest at task. They told Americans to follow the science. It is high time for the CDC and FDA to do the same. This is Nicole Sapphire, board-certified physician and Fox News medical contributor.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. Did you hear the news? Now you can. With instant updates from Fox News for Amazon Alexa. Just say,
Alexa, play news from Fox.
In Fox News.
It's the latest when you need it. On demand from Fox News and Amazon Alexa. The Will Cain Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Cain as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.